Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a call by the Kremlin to respect the will of the people in a secessionist referendum in eastern Ukraine that Russian President Putin claimed to oppose. Matthew Rojanski, the director of the Kennan Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center, joins us to discuss how much Putin is in control of events in Ukraine or is winging it, and the extent to which the U.S. is continually playing catch-up with a regime in Russia that is a unique geopolitical hybrid of organized crime and national security, the mafia and nuclear weapons. Then we'll examine the latest leaks about what the Federal Communication Commission might be proposing in terms of the future of net neutrality ahead of Thursday's vote on allowing public comment on new rules by the FCC. Sarah Morris, Senior Policy Counsel for the Open Technology Institute at the New America Foundation, joins us to discuss the new rules circulated today that will open up FCC plans for the future of the Internet to public comment, and the extent to which the FCC chairman, who has already received a blizzard of outrage over plans to allow fast lanes for content companies willing to spend payola to have internet service providers fast-track their content, will bend to the public's will over the lobbying power of the cable and telecom oligopolies. Then finally, we will speak with Brant Olson, the campaign director at Forecast the Facts, a grassroots community organization which, along with other public interest groups, is joining in demonstrations today at Google's annual shareholders meeting. We will discuss concerns that the company that avows the motto, "Don't be evil," is not providing transparency about its lobbying efforts and its membership of the Chamber of Commerce and ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, that is actively engaged in trying to kill solar power, which Google is underwriting. And joining us now is Matthew Rojanski, who is the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova. He has advised governments, intergovernmental organizations on conflict resolution and efforts to enhance shared security throughout the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian region. Previously, he was deputy director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he founded Carnegie's Ukraine program. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Rojanski.
Thank you, Ian. Happy to be with you.
And President Putin seems to have been engaged in a bit of kabuki theater about these elections or these secessionist referendums in the east of Ukraine, calling for them to postpone them or not to put them on at the same time, clearly now saying it's the will of the people. Do you think that Putin is winging it, or does he have some incredible master plan here? Because my understanding is if you use Mao Zedong's old dictum that it's better to have hegemony without responsibility, why would you want to end up with owning a deadbeat province like Donetsk?
Well, I think, first of all, Donetsk is a prize in and of itself. It is far beyond a deadbeat. It's actually one of the economic engines of Ukraine. Certainly the Donbass industrial region, which includes both Donetsk and Luhansk. But it also speaks to the larger prize here, which is the prize of Ukraine itself. And so in answer to your earlier question, I think it's a mixture of the two. I think that on the one hand, Putin is thinking strategically to a degree much more so than many others. Certainly many in the West have been able to do. We've been very reactive in the West. We have been on our heels basically since the crisis began, whereas I think Putin is thinking several moves ahead. But I think at the same time, he has to be opportunistic. He has to see how things develop on the ground. If it turns out, for example, that the referendum is able to begin momentum, which results in a critical mass of local citizens actually following through on the message of the organizers and really pushing away from the government in Kiev, well, then he has an entirely different situation on his hands. He doesn't have to manufacture anything. He can just ride that wave to de facto separation and perhaps annexation by Russia. On the other hand, if the majority, as the reliable polls have indicated thus far, continue to say that they want to stay in Ukraine, that they want to remain in a united Ukraine, that they oppose separation and independence, they oppose Russian intervention, you know, invading at that point would be a nightmare for Russia. It would destroy Putin's resurgent popularity at home, and it would be worse than the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan 30 years ago. And I think he's not that stupid. In that case, he would play the long-term game and try to have a hand in the shape of the new Ukrainian political order.
Well, it's pretty clear that he's either doesn't want to have these elections on May the 25th to take place or do everything he can to frustrate them. And it would seem now that if, based upon what the leaders of these self-declared autonomous republics who have put on this referendum, which the Kiev government refers to as a farce, they are now saying that they will not participate in the May 25th election. So that seems to be the strategy as far as I can see.
First of all, I'm not entirely sure that Putin is as opposed to this presidential election as he once was, for two reasons. First of all, he has come out and said, let's give the presidential election a chance. This is not a guy. He may have practiced deception. He may be using Kremlin media mouthpieces to mislead people, including the international community. But this is, by and large, a guy that, for his own domestic political reasons, tends not to say one thing and then take it back. There have been exceptions to that, but that's generally not his modus operandi. But second, and this is entirely speculative, but I think that the circumstantial evidence bears it out, I think he has to have cut a deal by now with the heir apparent to the Ukrainian presidency, Petro Poroshenko. The reason is Poroshenko, as of 2 weeks ago, was so far ahead in the polls that it became clear he would probably win in a first round, regardless of the level of participation in the election. He would win so dominantly in the West and in the center that no amount of opposition from the East could throw the election to Tymoshenko or to anyone else. What that meant was, for Poroshenko, he was about to inherit a country which was on the brink of disaster, which is about to be invaded by Russia, about to be dismembered. From Putin's perspective, it meant he couldn't control the outcome of the election. And if he can't stop the election from taking place in the first place, then he'd better have some scenario for the day after where he can actually deal with the guy who wins. And I think it's almost inevitable. Poroshenko has factories in Russia. He has good contacts that go all the way to the Kremlin. I think he has to have cut some kind of deal, and that's why Putin came out and said, yeah, go ahead and let the presidential election go.
And would that explain why the Party of Regions is apparently putting up candidates? So they're not boycotting the election in the East?
Well, I think there's going to be plenty of kind of, if you want to cherry pick your evidence that the election is legitimate because it has participation from the East, there'll be plenty of isolated evidence, evidentiary clumps that you can draw from. And one of those is participation by Regions Party candidates. Another will be that there will be voting in the East. I'm sure there will even be voting in Donetsk and Luhansk. After all, the separatist authorities do not control those provinces in their entirety. So it'll be just a question of numbers, and just as the separatist referendum organizers are doing now, a case can be made that, you know, there was enough of a plurality, a critical mass of people, that it's a legitimate vote. And as I say, I expect the victory by Poroshenko to be a large enough margin that it wouldn't have mattered anyway, that you know, 1 or 2 million votes one way or another from the East would not have changed the outcome.
Again, I'm speaking with Matthew Rajansky, who's the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. He's an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova, and he's advised governments, intergovernmental organizations on conflict resolution and efforts to enhance shared security throughout the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian region. Previously, he was deputy director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he founded Carnegie's Ukraine program. So my understanding is that on the ground in the East, most of the people in the middle just don't want all this strife. And it's basically being driven by the two poles on the East. About, 12 to 15% are stridently and violently pro-Russian. And on the Ukrainian or the Kiev side, there's about an equal amount. Is that how you see it, that most people are sitting on the fence in the East?
Look, I think it may have begun that way. It certainly is true that in the beginning of the Euromaidan movement, it was largely driven by a fringe of activists who were deeply dissatisfied with the corruption that everyone really resents in Ukraine, but that few people were willing to take concise, public steps to resist. Then it became dominated, or at least the violence was driven by real fringe groups, radical nationalists on one side, and then some pretty scary thuggish forces from the government on the other side. That was the narrative for the first 3 months. I think after Crimea, you had a hardening of positions to a very surprising degree throughout society. I mean, you have a great many people who are not particularly activist people. I mean, they haven't been involved in a lot of causes, but who are quite animated because they see their personal future on the line. It's like friends in Crimea have been telling me over the last month, you know, now very basic questions for them that are linked to their citizenship, like their right to keep their houses or their ability to conduct business and continue to put food on their table for their family. Those things have been implicated. And so it's not surprising that quite different from the traditional perception of post-Soviet apathy, I think people are starting to say, you know, it kind of does matter which direction this region goes, because it might end up, if I'm on the wrong side of it, first of all, I might lose, and it might end up costing me a lot.
Well, isn't that what's going on in Crimea to some extent? Is there some buyer's remorse going on there? Because they were very enthusiastic about the idea of joining Russia and raising their standard of living. But on the other hand, it goes to my question earlier about hegemony as opposed to responsibility. Isn't Putin taking on quite a financial burden there? My understanding is that there's a great deal of uncertainty about property rights and where things stand.
Yeah, Crimea is a complete nightmare right now. I mean, even the official reports from within the Russian government, at least to the extent that they have been made public, indicate very clearly that the Russian Federation's initial plans for integrating Crimea have gone completely off the rails, that they did not have the logistical capacity to hand out 2 million new passports, even assuming that everybody wanted them, and not everybody wants them, and that creates all kinds of complications. What do you do with the de facto reality of having huge numbers of people who want to remain as foreign citizens, but who control, you know, critical assets within a territory that now belongs to a new country? I mean, that is a major problem, and it will result, I think, invariably in a wave of what has been called corporate raiding, where essentially state-backed shadowy forces take over lucrative business assets. That's going to happen. There's going to be a redistribution, and it's already underway, of wealth, and that is going to have a ripple effect because you cannot hide this information, as many Western diplomats have rightly pointed out. In the age of the Internet, people in the East will find that out. People in the West will find that out. But what that will mean is that somebody who is, you know, more positively inclined towards Kiev, towards the European Union, but who lives in Donetsk and owns a business, let's say some kind of, you know, something related to the electrical power infrastructure or something related to communications, that person is going to be pretty certain that if he's caught on the wrong side of the separatist movement, he's going to lose everything.
Well, is that starting to dawn on people in the East, what's happening in Crimea? I mean, I thought from the very beginning, even though obviously the Europeans made this a zero-sum situation, which precipitated this whole crisis, the choices ultimately are between rule of law, an open society, and a kind of gangster form of capitalism.
Well, here's the tricky part of that. It's not a clear-cut choice between good governance and bad, because a lot of the people who are now involved in, not all of them, but a lot of the people who are now involved in the interim government who purport to represent, you know, new forces in Ukraine are in fact old faces. For example, the current governor of Dnipropetrovsk Oblast, which is the second most populous region in Ukraine, very wealthy, industrial, happens also to be in the southeast, is a guy who's known as a major corporate raider from the Yushchenko era, from the post-Orange Revolution, pro-Western period in Ukraine's history. And the same goes to a lesser degree for many other figures in the current government. And so I think plenty of people are understandably cynical when they look at the new forces. I mean, even Petro Poroshenko, right? He says all the right things, but he is still fundamentally an oligarch, right? He's known as the Chocolate King because he owns one of the most successful sweets companies in Ukraine, and he does lots of business in Russia. And he has, I think, conducted a reasonably clean business, but in the Ukrainian context, no one is clean. And people tend to assume that anybody who has significant wealth probably has been in bed with criminal or corrupt forces in order to get it. So I think there's no clarity about what this choice really means. I think there's a geopolitical choice here, which is people with nationalist Ukrainian views would prefer to be associated with Europe than they would with Russia, but that doesn't necessarily carry with it high confidence that there will be an elimination of corruption.
But isn't there also this other factor overriding everything, and that is who is going to take on the bills?
Yes, and it also depends on which bills, because remember, Ukraine essentially owes everybody money for everything. And it starts with the Russians, where you have a multi-billion dollar gas debt, but it runs up through, you know, obviously IMF and other international financial institution loans, Western banks and creditors, and then obviously Ukrainian moguls, you know, Ukrainian oligarchs who have, to a large degree, also financed the activities of government but have profited from them handsomely as well. So I think the question of Ukraine's financial survival is one in which, fundamentally, if Ukraine falls apart, everyone loses, because value, just objectively speaking, value will be lost in that chaos. However, there's a prisoner's dilemma problem here, which is that if Russia's financial leadership, if Russia's big businesses, if the Kremlin believe that they can eke out slightly more profit by pushing Ukraine towards the brink, versus the Western view, which has been basically if we can save and prop up the system, it's better for everyone, I think you could see Ukraine go over the edge.
So when you said earlier, Matthew Rudzinski, about Putin being a couple of steps ahead and thinking strategically, and our side in the West and here in the United States have been flat-footed, my understanding is, to just go to back to the beginning, they were flat-footed on the not being able to detect the Russian military buildup before they grabbed Crimea. Apparently, Secretary of State Kerry has complained about that he'd had no intelligence while he was talking to his Lavrov. He was completely blindsided by what happened. Some people have attributed that to Edward Snowden. I'm not sure what the real story is there. Do you have any information on that?
I don't have any classified information or insider knowledge of how the intelligence side of it works. But what I can tell you is I personally tried very hard for years, but certainly for 1 year, having just come back at that point from 2 months in Ukraine, where I was working with the U.S. Embassy on a fellowship, I tried very hard to push for a strategy towards Ukraine and the Western post-Soviet region, including Belarus and Moldova, which, by the way, are also in play. Many people have mentioned that Transnistria might be next on the chopping block. And the attitude of most senior officials, not only here in Washington, but in Berlin and elsewhere, was, look, there's a European association pathway. If the Ukrainians want to walk down that path, that's the strategy. And you know what? It wasn't enough. We were not thinking long term. We were not thinking about the step beyond the next step. We were not thinking about what happens if the Ukrainians say yes, if they actually go forward with the EU association, and all of a sudden we have created a new geopolitical reality on the ground. Are we prepared to invest in it? Are we prepared to defend it? Are we prepared to accept the reality of Ukraine at that time under Yanukovych? No one was really at a senior government level prepared to have those conversations. And I think, you know, John Kerry's complaint is actually very kind. I mean, narrowing it to a question of did we have particular tactical intelligence at a particular moment, I think this was a strategic failure. This was a failure to think of this region as a region that could potentially matter enormously for American interests.
Well, I think that's borne out by the fact that nobody seemed to have advised the Europeans about making this a zero-sum situation with the Ukrainians vis-a-vis Russia.
I think you're exactly right, Ian. Part of that is the perhaps the lack of experience, or just the institutional poor adaptation of the European Union bureaucracy to conduct a foreign policy. I mean, post-Lisbon, you have the portfolio, belonging to the EU to conduct strategic level foreign policy, and yet you don't actually have a long track record and a competency, and you don't necessarily have the connective tissue between the centers of expertise and knowledge nationally within, say, Germany, within France, the UK, Poland, connecting up to the EU mouthpiece and the EU diplomacy. What you do have, though, I think, is the building blocks of a very sound strategy. The idea that the Ukrainians would take certain reform steps in accordance with this EU association agreement, and that in so doing they would fundamentally transform their society, their economy, and their political system such that they could be compatible with the European Union and the broader West, I think is a very sound strategy. The Europeans also lacked a strategic vocabulary, so they kept describing this, you know, as I say, thoughtful strategy in incredibly shallow bureaucratic terms. You know, follow the rules, check the boxes, and we can take the next step. More for less, blah, blah, blah. They had all these kind of, you know, taglines. And I don't think any of this gave either the Ukrainians themselves, the Russians, or the United States a vision that we could really understand. We were looking to be inspired. We were looking to be reminded why this part of the world matters, why Europe is going to take responsibility for this part of the world. And I think what we got instead was kind of, as I say, you know, almost bureaucratic catchphrases.
But in terms of Kerry versus Lavrov and Obama versus Putin, which is to some extent how we frame things here, and it's also a political year, of course, and you've got John McCain always calling for more testosterone in foreign policy. Are we at a deficit in the sense that what you have in Russia is a new kind of political hybrid that is very, I don't think we've ever seen a situation where you have essentially a combination of organized crime and national security, the mafia and nuclear weapons?
Look, I think we have done no better when it comes to recognizing the potential importance of the U.S.-Russia relationship and thus understanding it in real depth and deploying a thoughtful strategy than we have with respect to Ukraine. The problem when it comes to Russia is, as you say, the stakes are much, much higher. I mean, this is a country that has the capability to destroy the world within an hour's time if they want to, the United States included. And I think the strategic blunder here was to assume in the 1990s that we could rebuild them in our image after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And then when that proved to be a much larger undertaking than we were prepared to invest in, I think collectively the West and the United States in the lead sort of walked off in a huff and said, okay, well, then you take care of yourselves. And, well, they have. And this is what they've come up with. And on the one hand, it is objectively true. Russians live better today than they have at any time in their history. And that's one of the reasons that Mr. Putin remains basically popular. On the other hand, they're still different. They are not living the way that people are in Western Europe. They're not even living the way people are in Central and Eastern Europe, who have now joined the European Union. They're living according to a different set of rules and expectations. And in that context, I think assuming that we can simply, as John Kerry has done, list the reasons why Mr. Putin is being dishonest or is wrong, and put our demands to them and say, come around to our view of the situation in Ukraine or else. You know, and if you agree with us, by the way, then we'll lift the sanctions. That's no way to conduct a negotiation with a country that has lifted itself off of its knees, sees itself as being, you know, one of the great powers in human history and certainly in today's world, and in fact is a superpower when it comes to nuclear issues.
Well, Matthew Rudzinski, I know you're off to Moscow and Kiev, and I'd love to talk to you when you get back, and I appreciate this conversation.
Happy to do so. Thanks a lot, Ian.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Matthew Rudzinski, who's the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. He's an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova, and he's advised governments, intergovernmental organizations on conflict resolution and efforts to enhance shared security throughout the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian region. Previously, he was deputy director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he founded Carnegie's Ukraine program. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the new rules by the FCC on the future of the internet.